Hi, my name is Roger Yates. I'm an ethical vegan from Dublin, Ireland, originally from Yorkshire, England. You can Google me on human-non-human relations. You're listening to the superb coexisting with non-human animals.
I know the human being and fish can coexist peacefully.
Vegetarian.
Vegan.
Yeah,
let's get it right.
You used the word animals, but I suppose what you should have said is non-human animals. If you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself, then make a change.
Hello and welcome to another fine episode of Coexisting with Non-Human Animals, the premier show of the Invercargill Vegan Society, coming to you from Invercargill, New Zealand, bottom of the world, and quite possibly the southernmost vegan society in the entire world. This episode, I'd like to play my diary entries. I'm trying not to say dairy there, I'm just used to saying dairy all the time. Who has a diary these days? I'd like to play my diary entries, recorded in audio form, from a recent trip to Auckland, the near top of New Zealand's North Island. And yes, the North Island is physically up, further north, than the South Island, on which I live at. Or on, I should say. Terrible grammar, Jordan. Terrible grammar. I flew 1,100 kilometres to attend the National Animal Rights Conference 2011, but, more importantly, to meet many vegan friends in person, including Emmy James, William Paul, and Elizabeth Collins of NZ Vegan Podcast. In fact, in the case of Elizabeth, I even got a hug.
Pal sent me a tweet saying that I was very excited and lucky to meet Elizabeth in person, and that I have to give her a hug from Pal. So, Pal, this is for you.
Big hug.
Love you, Pal.
Here are my diary entries, recorded in a tiny hotel room late at night. By the way, during the end of the first recording, I realised how paper-thin the walls were, that I didn't want to badmouth the hotel, with management possibly listening. Recording these, I was no doubt keeping the entire floor awake, just as bad as the huge fat guy next door watching bad sci-fi on his laptop. The year is 3069, all the men have died except for one nerdy gentleman who has his pick of all Earth's most beautiful ladies on the condition he repopulate the Earth. Oh, and the woman literally meters away from my room, who had a huge fight on the phone the first night, using the F word literally 100 times. I heard a snippet. The last thing I remember is you hitting my head against... And then, when that phone call was over, I didn't go over and offer help because she apparently had a friend staying with her. The very next night, I found out her female friend was a little more than just a friend, as they became very intimate and vocal, with one of the drunken lesbians slurring to the shower, "Babe, I'll get a bottle of wine and shag you all night!" Yes, fun times in Auckland, New Zealand. And with that mental image, may I present to you a series of recordings featuring a strange young man talking into an iPhone headset late at night in a very small, lime green, white and purple painted hotel room.
Hello everyone from Auckland, New Zealand. Well, it's the 20th of July and it's 42 years to the very day that Neil Armstrong and some other guy and that Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins was flying around the space pod and, you know, people floating around in space, and they apparently went to the moon, or they didn't, if you believe it was all filmed on a soundstage in Area 51. And on this day, 42 years ago, 1969, they did it, or they didn't do it. But I know that 42 years from that supposed date, that one Invercargill boy made it to Auckland. And as I stepped off the 737 as it arrived in Auckland, of course it was still going full speed, I sort of jumped out as it was going 900 kilometres above Auckland Airport. Yeah! Luckily I had my faithful parachute, and I looked at the safety briefing to duck and cover and tuck your head in against the seat in front of you, and if the mask falls from the sky and the rear cushion, it like floats in the ocean, you know, bobbing in the middle of the damn Pacific Ocean, that sounds safe. It's good planning. It was all well and good, and I made it here, although I did record it. You won't be able to hear, you won't be able to make it out, because those jet engines, they are kind of noisy, a little bit loud. But I know that I said it. One small step for man, one giant leap for Invercargill kind. So here I am in Auckland, and it's the 20th of July, 2011. And today I met Emmy James, I met Elizabeth Collins, and I met William Paul and Emmy's mother and William's mother. Maybe tomorrow I'll meet Elizabeth's mother, I'm not sure. But I've had a great day today. We went to Revive, which is a restaurant, cafe sort of place, and they had a lot of vegan options. It was great. I had some kind of a tofu soup thing with pad thai noodles on the side, and that was lovely. And we tried looking for one geocache around Albert Park and couldn't find it, unfortunately. I think it might be moved on, which is sad, especially when you're taking other people and like they've never found a geocache before. It's always very embarrassing when you can't find the damn thing. But with William afterwards, as we're about to walk back to my hotel now and to his apartment, we did manage to find one down at the harbour, at the viaduct, at the waterfront, whatever we want to call it in Auckland. And it was hidden on the red fencing that everyone's seen from pictures and videos and photographies and the like. So that was exciting, a magnetic little mint container, an Eclipse mint container held on magnetically to the back of an embellishment, on the sort of wrought iron embellishment. It's been a great day, and tomorrow I have many more exciting things to do. I'm recording this in my 3 meter wide apartment, hell, it's like a prison cell, my little hotel room. It's really nice, I really like the juicy hotel, and I'm really glad to be here. I'm glad I made it alive in one piece after jumping out of a Boeing 737 at 900 kilometers an hour. And all I can do is thank my air hostess, who showed me where the emergency exits were, and who showed me what to do. I mean, to kiss my bum goodbye as I jumped out of the plane, and hey, it worked, because I'm recording this. I'll talk to you the same time tomorrow. Coming to you pre-recorded in the city of Sails, Auckland, New Zealand, it's your host, Jordan Wyatt. And today is the 21st of July. It's the 21st of July, 2011. And today, I had a wonderful time with Emmy and William. And we went geocaching around the Auckland CBD. We found a few. I didn't find two because the GPS apparently goes crazy around those giant buildings they have up here. Rather than manageable size buildings such as the Calvin Hotel or the Water Tower, they have lots of like the Waldorf Hotel and the Sky Tower, which are a little bit bigger, just a little bit. And that sends the GPS satellite signals all scrambled and bounced and absorbed and reflected and who the devil knows what. So sometimes it says you're 50 metres away, then you're 20 metres away, and then you're 5 metres away, and then you're 70 metres in the wrong direction. So it's a bit of fun. I've been given a couple of clues from people who have found those two before, and I hope to do them tomorrow. And today I got to go to the Golden Age restaurant. The Golden Age restaurant was wonderful. The Golden Age all-vegan restaurant. Fantastic. Located right by the Sky Tower. It was a very reasonably priced meal. It was cheap. The menu was incredible. I took pictures of every page of the menu. Everything about it was great. I loved it. And I would do almost anything to have one of those in Invercargill, to go there all the time. And really, what more could you ask for? It was nice to meet all the people that I'd seen pictures and online before. And just to see everything on the menu, just to have an endless, well, okay, not endless, maybe 30 things to choose from. It was overwhelming. And I hope to go back tomorrow and in future days while I'm still up here. Well, tomorrow the conference begins, Friday night, and I'll be wearing my suit and hoping to meet as many people as possible and to sign up some more members. So until then, I hope everything goes well at the conference, and I'll talk to you tomorrow. Hello from Auckland, New Zealand. Today it's Friday night, and I've just attended the first of the three-part Animal Rights Conference, the National Animal Rights Conference 2011, or as I like to call it, NARC. Tonight, we had the event in the Town Hall, the Auckland Town Hall, and it started off, I went there and recognised some faces, and I looked around to see what the first word I'd see on a sign inside would be, and it was welfare, and it was something about supporting welfare, and you know, I was kind of expecting it. I was expecting a lot of animal welfare stuff at the Animal Rights Conference. And I looked around and there were lots of vegan cupcakes and things. They were great. There were savoury muffins and cupcakes, sweet cupcakes and muffins. And tea and coffee. There were lots of groups, stalls for the Vegan Society for animal rehoming with Linda Nunn. That was great. And the Animal Sanctuary, there was quite a few. And I saw the Greens there. The Greens had a stall. And the Greens stall was particularly interesting because they have a piece of paper. Isn't it a bit odd that animal welfare is regulated by the Ministry of Agriculture and Forestry? Yes, we think so too. And that's why they made it a question. What is the Greens' view of animal rights? In our policy on animal welfare, the vision statement is that the intrinsic worth of animals be recognised. This is the ideal towards which we strive. One of our charter principles is that of non-violence, and we believe that this should be extended to non-human animals as well. However, it is important to make the distinction here between animal welfare and animal rights. A legal recognition of the intrinsic worth of animals would mean a move away from the view of non-human animals as property. This would bring us into the position of, guess who, Gary Francione, who has asserted that the only rights non-human animals really need is the right not to be property. In any event, the law of Aotearoa New Zealand, the Animal Welfare Act 1999, is focused only on the prevention of cruelty or ill treatment, in the words of the Act. So while we support animal rights, as a parliamentary political party, we can only work with the law as it is and aim for the best outcomes and welfare law, and there is still plenty to be done. Well, that's pretty cool. I mean, that's the best thing that any of them could possibly say. They can't say, we in the Green Party, who get about 5 to 10%, maybe tops, of the vote, are going to make something which 99% of the country do completely illegal, and they will go to Gitmo for it. We will bring back capital punishment. It's just a terrible thing, and that's what they've got to work with. They can't promote veganism. They won't get the votes. So what would we expect? Well, there was a political debate, and there was a Labour guy, and there were jokes about this poor Labour guy because Labour was a past government, and they're bloody useless. Just everything Labour does is wrong at the moment, and when they say they're for something, they screw it up, and when they say they're not for something, they screw it up, and just everything they do, just everything is wrong about them. The whole party just fell apart when Helen Clark left to do some UN gig, and they're just rudderless, they're useless. So we also had the guy from the Green Party, Gareth Hughes, I believe his name was, and he's vegetarian. And he mentioned something, well, I went vegetarian at the age of 17 when I found out, and our party is the only one that has the animal welfare thingamajig. And we care about the animals at the Green Party, and we recognise that we shouldn't hurt other animals. And then he said something really weird. He said he saw non-veganism versus veganism and everything as a matter of personal choice, and it was just up to you what we do. And yeah, that's a bit weird. I mean, he didn't see it as a rights violation then, in that sense of the term. And that got some boos and it got some weird responses, because supposedly the Greens are the party that people would want to be voting for. But yeah, that's the answer. He saw it as a personal choice. Although they are very for animal welfare, and apparently it's not a personal choice that the cages have to be a certain size before we kill them, which the killing of them is a personal choice. So, you know, wagging the tail there. The dog gets wagged too, along with the tail, to really mess up that little analogy. And finally, the last guy, after the United Future one got lost in traffic, or who the hell knows, abducted by aliens, there was a guy from ACT. And ACT is our main sort of far right by New Zealand standards. They're probably, you know, in some things they're in line with the Democrats, let's be honest, in America. So in New Zealand they'd be considered probably far right, and they're generally sort of older white men vote for them, and that's their kind of thing, you know, can't trust these immigrants, and free trade's a good thing, quit your wine and we don't need unions. Nuclear power might be a good thing. Maybe we should do our bit. We should help out in defence overseas. You know, we should join in those lovely wars overseas. Climate change is a bit of a, you know, it's a bit weird, I think. That's the kind of party they are. So on a lot of things, they're about the same as the Democrats, and they're considered far right for New Zealand politics, ACT. So it just goes to show. And that guy, he came up and said, oh, we don't believe in the government or something, so that sounds a bit libertarian of him. We don't believe in the government's right to sort of start whining and creaching orders. And he said something about, you know, market pressure will drive the best product and all that kind of stuff. The guy got booed, and there could have been a lynch mob for him, really. But it was incredible to be there. It was quite long, some of it. The seats were uncomfortable. I sort of squirmed a bit. Carl Scott was there, the man who was in the cage, and I really like Carl. He's a nice person. He was a slaughterhouse worker. He worked killing animals, and now he's vegan. I really liked it when he was on the close-up program and the television programs I saw him on. He said, well, I'm vegan, but I don't think the world is going to go vegan overnight. So until then, I'm for the bigger cages. It's a bit like the Green Party thing. I sort of knew he wasn't going to say, well, I'm vegan and I think veganism is where it's at. I knew he wasn't going to say that. I guess that was the best I could realistically expect from him. It's not what I would say or do, but, you know, I'm glad. It's about one of the few times I've ever heard the word vegan, V-E-G-A-N, said on mainstream New Zealand television. So I don't think I've ever heard SAFE mention it. I don't think I've heard Open Rescue mention it. I don't think I've ever heard of it before, heard it used on mainstream primetime television. So well done on that, Carl. Well done on deciding you wanted to be vegan. And I hope in the near future you'll decide to promote veganism, vegans who promote veganism, and we believe this is the truth and that we love other animals and that we shouldn't hurt them. And ta-da, promoting veganism. Well, I was really enthralled with today's, or tonight's event, I should say. I was there with Emmy and William, and I saw a few other vegans I know. Hey, Jesse, I heard Chris Noiro behind me. I saw Deborah Ashton from Animal Rights and Wrongs, Hans Creek, lots of people from SAFE. There were heaps and heaps of people, Michael Scott, and Michael Morris as well. Michael Scott was somewhere. Just heaps of people, Jan, Sarah. It was good. It was a good time. And I'm really looking forward to waking up at like 5 a.m. in the damn morning or something. It's going to be pitch black, fighting for a shower, and hopefully being already at 6 something for William to meet me here before we go and take a boat. Presumably while it's still dark at around 7 in the morning, we take a 15-minute boat to the North Shore. Taking a boat, I mean, honestly, this crazy Auckland place. We're taking a boat at 7-odd in the morning, and it lasts for 15 minutes. Then when we get to the North Shore, or if we sink and die and drown, and I have to eat the others, you know, to survive, on the planks, bobbing around in the Pacific Ocean, ending up in Australia or in Antarctica, one of the two, probably Antarctica, damn it. Or I might be able to catch a ride back to Invercargill, I don't know. Things tend to go down, that lovely gravity thing that we get 2 hours a day of here in New Zealand. If I make it to the North Shore alive, and I didn't have to eat other people to get there, I'll end up taking a bus, and if William's still alive too, I'm going to be following him, and we'll take a bus to the Rose Centre, which is sort of like a pre-scroll thing, and it's got like a theatre, like a presentation room, stage, something. And so, yeah, I've got a lot to look forward to, and it's about 11:30 at night now, and so I better go to bed, and so that I can wake up at 5 or so in the morning, hopefully I'm not going to sleep in and miss this and go like, oh yeah, it's actually the 27th now, and I have to go back to Invercargill. Hopefully I'll wake up in time, and I'll be able to check into you tomorrow. Hey everybody from Auckland, New Zealand. It's Saturday the 23rd. I'm just back from the first main full day, the Saturday event, after having the Friday, and now Saturday. This was held on the North Shore, and so to get there, we walked to Britomart and to the ferry centre, the ferry station, which is just opposite Britomart, which is the train and the bus station, and so we take a boat to the other side, to the North Shore, from Auckland, the main Auckland CBD. And once on the North Shore, we had to find the bus, and the bus driver wasn't exactly sure what route to take. Turns out the bus went to the right place, and we made it to the school, the Rose Centre. So the Rose Centre was a nice little building. It's sort of like a school community hall thing. And it has sort of a cafeteria area. It has toilets. It has a few main function rooms. And it's got a theatre. And the theatre's got a couple hundred seats or whatever it is. And it's quite interesting. And so the first event, so I went there with Emmy and William. William met me at my apartment. I keep calling it that. I don't think much of apartment living in this tiny little 2 meter wide cubicle, this prison cell, this hotel room. And we walked to Britomart together and then down to the ferry and we met Emmy there. Emmy took a bus, I believe. Either that or she was dropped off. She lives a few suburbs away. It was introduced when we got there around 8 a.m. and around 9 a.m. it started. It was introduced by Deborah Ashton of Animal Rights and Wrongs. And then Alice Leonard did an introduction and she mentioned, guess what, a bunch of small grassroots groups in New Zealand. And one of it she mentioned was the abolitionists, as it said on the big slide, on the big projector. And it had a picture of Elizabeth Collins, her table with all her pamphlets, the abolitionist approach ones, and Boston Vegan Association, a few others, and in different languages on her table, a close-up of that. And the slide before that, the Invercargill Vegan Society, and it was a picture of my hand with a couple of the badges in it. And so that was sort of the dramatic angle, and the lighting looks good, and it was quite a cool picture, and it looked really well on the projector. And they mentioned Jordan White of the Invercargill Vegan Society. They mentioned, I made a couple paragraphs that I sent to Alice when she asked. And it was something like, the Invercargill Vegan Society was founded in the last years of 2010, being quick to beat 2011 to the punch, to make it seem like a whole year more established, as if we've been around a whole year longer, as it really makes a difference, those few days rushing ahead. And so that was cool. That was cool to be mentioned on the projector. And it was cool that Elizabeth was mentioned on the projector. What she and William do, the tabling in the streets when they have a table and they get out there and they promote veganism and they have pamphlets about veganism. Not bigger cages, not feeling good about bigger cages. They promote veganism on the streets and they talk with everyone who wants to hear and who wants to speak with them and wants to learn about veganism. So after that, Hans Krieg of SAFE, he had a little talk about animal rights in New Zealand, celebrating victories and achievements is the name of it. And that was about Jumbo the circus elephant. I've always called her a Miss Elephant or Mrs. Elephant before that. How she's currently living in a zoo after being in the circus for something like 30 years. And they hope to send her to America, to live in a sanctuary in America. There's the pig crates. Oh, we got Mike King. He was a big, tough bloke. He wasn't a stereotypical vegan or anything, and now he promotes the good kind of happy meat. Carl Scott, the man in the cage, this from slaughterhouse worker to vegan campaigner. He's a really nice guy, Carl. He lives just outside of Dunedin, which he lives on the South Island. He lives quite near the bottom of the South Island like I do. He's a couple hundred kilometres north of me, but he's, you know, kindred spirits, let's say. He's a very nice man. And he spoke about how he made sort of a continuum kind of thing, counting on your fingers how many sort of have you killed animals yourself directly? Have you eaten other animals ever in your life? And there were only 3 vegetarians or vegans for life in the audience. So out of a couple hundred people, I'm not sure how many people are there, a couple hundred, let's say 3. There really was 3 that had never eaten the flesh of another animal. And so that's really something to think that those people there, there were 3 of them. And Carl mentioned all the things he had done and how he felt like he was the most evil person in the room because he'd done the most different types of killing aquatic animals and killing cows, I think, sheep, everything. And then he was in the army and he got trained as an infantryman to shoot them up full of holes and then how to patch them up as a medic. That was his main thing, as a medic. After that we had morning tea, coconut and cranberry loaf or banana walnut loaf. The banana walnut loaf was gluten free and that was better, but coconut and cranberry loaf, that was very good too. Then at 11 a.m. Appetite for Justice, launching food empowerment project. Lauren, I always forget her name, Cornelius is how I like to say it, like Cornelius. The food empowerment project, which is sort of like workers' rights and water rights, the sort of water privatization. fair trade chocolate, slave chocolate, she sort of calls most of it, because all the cocoa beans or cacao beans, they come from the same African countries generally, and they have sort of 5-year-olds working and just an awful, awful, awful lifestyle. It's just terrible. Machetes hacking at bushes to get the cocoa beans. And we all support that by buying chocolate. And she said she basically doesn't have chocolate anymore. And there are a couple groups that she sort of says, you know, these are, yeah, they're all right. It's vegan and it's the fairest of trades. Undertaking international investigations and effective campaigns, Lynn White, Animals Australia, the live export. And she spoke about the videos she'd made, and she got into tears a few times, and she normally wasn't this affected, and she said that she could really feel it. I can feel it calling in the air tonight. There's the Phil Collins song goes. Just being with the other people, she noticed. And so that went pretty well. It was a matter of, I wanted to ask questions, but we ran out of time. At the end, which is really sad, I wanted to ask a question because I felt that her presentation and the way that people are responding to it, especially, is that it's an issue of race, and it all depends on how we see people who believe in another supernatural Superman in the sky that's different from the supernatural Superman that we ourselves tend to believe in our countries and our cultures and traditions. And that these people are somehow evil and just cruel, nasty people. And that we can't trust these evil people on the other side of the world who have this strange religion which we hate, which we blame all our ills on now. And I felt it really came across as that, just the way people have that us and them kind of attitude, good and evil. That they really are evil, and that the current thing is kill Australian animals, and Australia seems to be the campaign. Because it's not the vegans that seem to be running a lot of the smaller groups that are getting, you know, people are getting active themselves. They feel like they want to get involved. They're writing hundreds of thousands of letters to the MPs and politicians about this. They are pissed off about this in Australia. And it's not vegans who are leading all these sort of small, like, sort of lynch mob groups. And you get the feeling if it wasn't weeks away by boat or, like, by plane, it wasn't some ungodly journey. They just go up there and beat the hell out of those awful Muslim Indonesian slaughterhouse workers. They see them as evil. And my question would be, I'd mentioned something, my friend in the audience, a non-native English speaker, he mentioned that he saw speciesism, as he used the word speciesism too, and he said he saw that like racism. He saw it as treating others differently because they look somewhat different to us, and we perceive them as different, and that wasn't right, that we were all equal wherever it mattered, however it mattered. And I thought that was really moving. I would have mentioned that too, and I showed my friend, I showed him the image, I'll get the order wrong, but you know what I mean. It's the faces basically, and racism equals sexism equals speciesism, and yes, I know I've got the order wrong, right? No, I've probably got it perfectly right now. I'm saying I've got it wrong, but I had it right. Damn it. And so that's a really moving image. And if I had my time, I would have stood up and showed a couple of pictures on my iPad just to show that we're New Zealanders and we think we're better than Australians who think they're better than Indonesian sort of house workers. And that our ones, just sexual abuse, just what goes on in slaughterhouses here. I know from my father being there, I know from talking with farmers, I know what goes on, what they tell me. The way they sort of talk about cutting off tails and eating them and eating testicles and like cutting them and biting them open and just like just the most disgusting things you can imagine. And it's nothing we want anything to do with Jamie Mackay or James Mackay, who writes in the Southland Times, and he has the farming show, and it's got an image of sort of sexual abuse, getting behind man having sex with a sheep, and that's like their logo, which is, it's the lowest of the low. You can't get much lower than that. And this is a man that gets paid the big bucks to run our newspapers and host TV programs and radio shows and everything. So I just wanted to mention, do you feel comfortable with this image? Do you ever think that if we all promote explicit veganism and mention veganism and that we believe in veganism and agree with veganism, isn't that about asking each other to look in the mirror, as Mr. Jackson says, and to see what we can do? Rather than blaming someone else, blaming another supernatural, super being religion on the other side of the world and behind closed walls. After that, for lunch we had curried kumara soup and bread, wholemeal falafel wraps, crunchy nut coleslaw with tahini dressing, creamy potato and garden salad, which was gluten-free. Then it was profiling an effective campaign action. New Zealand Open Rescue, Deirdre Sims. And that was talking about what Open Rescue does. That's the stuff about asking for bigger cages. And if I could have had a question for her, it would have been that I'd seen the work in sort of many international countries, mainly Spain, say, animal equality, and how they do the same kind of things. They go in and they rescue animals, or steal, rescue, liberate, whatever you want to say. They take animals out of suffering and they save their lives, whatever it's called by the law. And they do it, and they promote veganism while doing it. Our Open Rescue seems to be basically the only Open Rescue that works like this in the world, and that our Open Rescue in New Zealand, that calls themselves Open Rescue, they promote welfare. They go to Safe, and then Safe asks for the bigger cages and ban this type of cage, and we like the good, don't buy the cruel pork, and that kind of stuff. And in their eyes, that means go vegan, apparently. And everyone else's eyes, it's presented as the cruel factory-farmed evil pork, and then it's the free-range pork, so... And that would have been my question. After that, there was the streaming workshop. You could pick from one of three things. Animal Rights 101 with Ming Zhu. Number two, Empowering You as a Leader, Sean Bishop, who's Leadership Unlimited and the Animal Sanctuary. Number three, Animal Welfare Law in New Zealand. How do animal exploiting industries ignore the five freedoms? And for that, I picked the first one, Animal Rights 101, and it was one of the leaders of Animal Freedom Aotearoa, which I sort of think of as a sort of ALF, Open Rescue kind of group. They sort of do the little break-ins, liberating, rescuing, whatever, and they sort of get involved with anarchy and eco-feminism and a bunch of things. It's all that kind of violent, direct action stuff. I don't think they believe in beating up people, but... I don't know. It's sort of like an Open Rescue ALF kind of stuff. And that sort of it went into an open-ended question of people in the audience asking each other questions and talking. And there were a few non-vegans there, and they said, well, I think, you know, Safe goes too far by saying don't kill other animals, and it's never going to happen, so they should focus, you know, I only eat the good stuff. And I asked one of them a question. He was asking that. I asked one of them a question about chickens, that I looked after my chicken friends, and I explained the chicken friend, chicken fried, and the you and the n, looking at yourself, the you. The only difference between fried and friend is a little n, and if you look at the letter n, give it the old rotate, look in the mirror, it's you. Look at what you can do to help turn them from fried to friends. And I asked if he was in a country overseas where they killed cats and dogs, would he try? But surely that's... it's okay, right? It's okay to kill other animals. And he said no. And I asked then, was it a matter of societal norms, what you grow up with? And he said, yeah, yeah. And then I said, well, don't you agree that there's no real difference in value of a life between, say, the chicken friends I know and love, and who sit on my lap or my knee, and they like to be patted, some of them. Sometimes they don't like being patted all the time. They have their own personalities and minds. They choose when they want to be patted. Just like you might have a cat or dog who likes to be patted sometimes, and they don't want to be picked up at other times. And he didn't really have an answer for that. And then the conversation moved on a bit. But it was good to get it off my chest. It was good to ask him that, and maybe he will think about it. I saw that man looking at some pamphlets afterwards, and maybe he has started to think about it more. After that, there was a tea break and part two. You could pick between one of three things. Animal activism, getting active for animals. Mark Hawthorne, author and activist, and that's Striking at the Roots. Empowering as a Leader, part two. More from Sean Bishop of Leadership Unlimited and the Animal Sanctuary. And the third one that you could choose from, How to Influence for Animals. Understanding people better to reach your goals, which is sort of hypnotism and neuro-linguistic programming. You are in my power. That kind of stuff. I went with the first one again, Animal Activism, Getting Active for Animals, with Mark Hawthorne, and he gave a whiteboard presentation about getting active and avoiding burnout, and it was the questions about burnout, just taking time for yourself, staying fit, staying exercised, enjoying time with friends, so you don't get sick of everything we're doing. The last one, it was meant to be Why I Am Vegan, Glenn Owens, psychology professor, pilot, and vegan for 35 years, but he couldn't make it for some reason. And so the last thing was an open panel discussion asking people about how they went vegan and things like that with all the other previous guests. And the last thing of the day, we stayed behind, William and I, Emmy had to go. We had a veg barbecue, and that was $10, and we stayed there. And there were some presentations, and there were sort of patties and sausages and salad, falafel kind of tahini wraps, salad, things that you can make for yourself, shish kebabs. And I mean, I must have had like $30 of food, let's say, for $10. So it would have cost three times as much retail price, surely, for what we all got. So there's pre-recorded presentations from, excuse me for butchering her name, to use a term, Marianne Thiem, TM, she's Dutch, party for the animals in the Netherlands, an elected party, so I guess it's like MMP here, they work for supposed animal rights, it'll be animal welfare stuff, but it's described as animal rights. There was a Brazilian man, George Guimarães Vedas, V-E-D-D-A-S, I'm sorry to my Portuguese listeners. He talked about the things that they were working on there, and that Sao Paulo, 20 million people and 200 million cattle, but they get active there promoting veganism. And then there was a live Skype discussion with Martin Bellick, the Austrian guy, and all the different welfare cage bands and things, and he was an interesting guy, and he was talking about the police influence and corruption and just trying to crack down on him and making up all kinds of charges and things, and he swore quite a few times, F this and F that, and he made a joke, so what if I said, oh, I'm going to burn down this thing, and they take that out of context, he was saying, because they're recording all his emails and all kinds of things. And so hopefully I can talk about all these speakers a little bit more in future. And tomorrow I'm going back for the final event, the Sunday event, so I'm waking up early. And the same thing again, so I'll talk to you tomorrow. Hello everyone from Auckland, New Zealand. Today was the last event of the National Animal Rights Conference 2011. Today is the Sunday, the 24th of July. Well, again, William and I, well, William actually met me at the hotel today, and we left, I got up around 6 a.m. in the morning, which is really early for me, and we made it there to the ferry terminal at about 7 o'clock. From there we took the boat, that's a boat, to the North Shore, Devonport, and that's a 10-minute journey, costing a few, couple of dollars or something. And on that other side, then we took a bus and we managed to make it all okay, and the bus arrived perfectly fine. So it's all exciting for me. I'm not used to taking public transport, let alone at least two options and waking up at 5 a.m. something. The first, we got there really early. We were there before the meet and greet, just as people were walking in the doors. We were there, Emmy, myself, William. And the first thing was a welcome from the MC of the day, Glenn Real, who's a SAVE board member, and he just talked about what was planned for the day and a few things about veganism. The first real workshop that started was Campaign Strategies for Success, How to Effectively Research and Investigate an Animal Abuser, from Lauren from the Food Empowerment Project, and she was really good to talk to again and to hear. And I disagree very strongly with her about single-issue campaigns, for example. She's run campaigns to ban duck meat in certain restaurants, the flesh of dead ducks, and part of the concern was that they didn't have enough, that they weren't given access to water while they were kept in these barns and sheds and all kinds of awful places. And I disagree with her about the single issues, but she's definitely a very good speaker. She's a very genuine person, I felt. And just really, really a nice person, and it's hard to fault her presentation. Part of the takeaway message I got was to know sort of your limits, to know what your group's about, and she mentioned for some things that the Food Empowerment Project was a vegan organisation, But there were some things that they'd sort of back away from, and they knew that other groups would take it as sort of a welfare thing, to know your niche in a way, and that maybe she could start things, but she really wouldn't want to promote anything to do with non-veganism in some ways, or yeah. Although they do focus on single issues in other ways, it's all a little complicated for me to focus on one thing like the selling of duck flesh, and then say to be a vegan organisation, for example. After her, there was media communication, Sonia Dufries of TV3. She's a journalist. She's on TV3, a second large television channel for news. And it's amazing to see someone you know from watching on television back when people watched those televisual things before we all had this thing called the internet and we went to 3news.co.nz to see 3news rather than pushing the 3 button on a plastic remote which we had to point and it shot a beam of light, but it's invisible to the human eye. It's outside of the spectrums that we can see, this infrared, I believe it was called. And then this thing, it would like flash images at you and... Until a couple of years ago, they were often made out of big, heavy glass tubes, but now they're made out of like a cheap plastic thing, like on a computer monitor, but nowhere near as high resolution. But yeah, there used to be this thing, and it was called television. And I think some people over the age of, say, 60 or 70, they still hang on to the old thing, some old banger. Got lots of wood panelling on the sides of it and about a 9-inch screen diagonally. And she sort of mentioned that news media, newspapers especially, it's all just sort of, in my terms, crapping out. It's absolutely going to hell. And she just was saying, look at what Twitter gets now. You see when things are trending worldwide, boom, you can chart how many people are talking about it on Twitter. And it just kicks the crap out of anything that newspapers or any kind of radio bulletins or anything can do, really, compared to just having the voice of the people. And she mentioned Vox Pops, and she said she's been a journalist all this time and she didn't know what it stood for, and I'm like, really? And I'm like, well, I suppose I've heard of Vox Pops before, and I sort of learned more about them through the wonderful, often imitated but never beaten, Dr. Roger Yates, England's finest sociologist living in Ireland, being really specific there, perhaps. And just, I was going to say that I was going to make a joke. I didn't have time to answer that question. The question time is always really stressed. Everything to do with this conference seems... everything's always running behind schedule, and there's always, whenever someone's talking in a separate workshop, there is always someone walking in, like, the door every few minutes to tell you, like, hold up 5 fingers, 5 minutes left, 4 minutes left, 2 minutes left, 1 minute left. You know, everything's always really rushed for time, and on the first days, it was okay this day, but the first days, there was a lot of sound errors and things, lots of feedback and just random noise and things, and it seemed a bit rushed. Today, we had a lot of time constraints, so people got told they could only have 2 questions or so, or last question, that sort of thing. And that's always a bit of a disappointment when you're putting your hand up, and it's just a matter of whose hand gets seen first, or where the speaker is looking with the lights on the audience and everything. But my question would be to explain, you know, that I would make a joke that I was putting on a normal New Zealand English accent, and then I was going to go back into my Southern accent when I answer questions, Vox Populi, voice of the people, bloody oaf, mate, yeah, Southland. And being a Southlander, I should be celebrating right now. My local, supposedly, rugby team, and not the American rugby, and not football, soccer, but, you know, New Zealand rugby, like Australian rugby, except for not Aussie rules, which is some kind of demon seed, you know, bastard spawn of the real rugby, the rugby. My supposed local team, Southland, have won the Ranfurly Shield, which is like winning the America's Cup. And if you're into like racing little boats around in circles and stuff and not using motors, they use this thing called the wind and these big like bed sheets or something from like a king-size bed, I think. So yeah, the America's Cup is now New Zealand's Cup. Well, the Ranfurly Shield is now Southland's Shield, apparently. So my dad will be getting, you know, absolutely hammered. Yay! Great. But yeah, Vox Pops, the voice of the people, however you say it, I'm terrible, so yeah, voice of the people. And so that's when you get that kind of local flavour, the man on the street, and that's where I get that, kind of stuff from Van der Hayes, the Fonterra chairman guy who gets paid a couple hundred thousand a year to give statements such as, hey, 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 na, 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 you can't ask me that, hey, 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 na, 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 when he was asked if his farms, if they performed essentially abortions, they call them inductions, but it's, you know, abortions of pregnant mother cows. And Sonia just sort of mentioned repeating your points to the media when you're being interviewed, to have a few statements and to repeat them, the best times of day to submit stories you knew about that you were involved with, and that often journalists were just flat stick busy all the time, that you had to make things easy for them, and if you to just to try and avoid the tricks they'd use on people. So when they'd say things like, do you think that the life of an animal is worth the same as a human being? And do you think it's wrong to hurt them both? And things like that. And then the newspaper will lead with a headline like, animal rights extreme, you know, radical activist says human babies are worth less or the same or not as important as the animals, something like that. That they spin what you said and they'll put words into your mouth and that kind of thing. And I didn't think there was any easy way to avoid things like that. She just said if you felt like you were being strung out a bit, perhaps you could contact the producer or whatever. I'm presuming this is like a big kind of media piece, more than talking to little old Jordan Wyatt of the Invercargill Vegan Society with the big the big fluffy microphone, as she jokingly called it, you know, the sound mic, for people being recorded for news. But the statement would be just always stick to your points, I guess, overall, would be her takeaway. To stick to your points, to know what you talk about, to have maybe five things if you're really confident, to have maybe three or even one single issue, and just to repeat statements and say, like, well, we promote veganism, and they'll say, but don't you think with the starving children, and then you say something like, well, Kate, or insert name here, I think that's a most interesting question, and I care deeply about what you say. We at the Invercargill Vegan Society promote veganism. To just keep repeating the thing and to say something like, oh, that's a good idea, hey, that's a very good question, I've thought about that, and my answer is, and you just keep repeating your points, hammering it home, so they can't possibly get anything else from you. Although, I do worry that they'll just say, bugger this guy, and they'll just kick you off from the whole thing. Because, you know, they record for hours, and then use, they make a minute 30 sort of piece, she said, and maybe for the really long ones in the weekend, it might be closer to 2 minutes. And the average person gets about, I think it was 21 or 24 words or something, about 7 seconds is sort of like the sound bite that people often get. So about 7 seconds will be featured. I appreciated hearing someone on the other side. She's not vegan. I'm assuming that a lot of the speakers today were not vegan. They look like they're wearing bags and shoes and things made out of skin, and I just haven't heard that they're vegan. So they were talking more about being an activist, and that's a bit broad, you could say, for the Animal Rights Conference. But it was good with Sonia DeVries. She's a very well-known journalist. You see her on the news media. When you go to the website, and for Grandma, when she looks at that thing called a television, you see her on there, and I think it's really good that she sort of led us into her little tricks. And one thing I didn't like with all this sort of recent news about the Spanish 12 and everything, and how our pork board here had supposedly been putting GPS tracking devices on open rescue kind of people, and the police informers that were pretending to be animal rights activists and sleeping with people and monitoring them and getting paid by the police and all this. She mentioned that reporters, this is common, that when they're in the news truck and the news vans and that they're using sort of police scanners, I assume, to intercept text messages and phone calls and all kinds of things. And the way I understand is I've got an old police scanner, and I've never been into it, but I bought a cheap one. And I was just interested more as a general radio in some ways, just to explore the frequencies that you could hear. I'm not really that interested. I've got friends that leave them on all the time and listen to the police. Yeah, we've got a 5479 on Esk Street, and that's a man, I don't know, being sick in public or something. And then they tell the police now know people are listening, so they say, ring me on 021-02222, and they have a private phone call. Except, now the reporters can apparently easily pluck the radio signals from cell phones out of the air, including text messages. And I guess it's the high-end police scanners. You can put them to sort of a data mode. They're about at least $1,000 American, let's say, the ones I've seen before. The really high-end Unidens and all that. And they do different encryption and decryption, obviously, things. And so I guess it's something like that. I mean, I'm sure it's off the shelf, and it's whatever encryption's used on most standard cell phones to the GSM frequencies and 1900 megahertz and all that. They tune it to that, and then they somehow have the key to decrypt whatever it is. And yeah, just the idea that they can decide, okay, I'm going to listen into Jordan White's number. So what's Jordan White's cell phone number? 0210-222. Yeah, it's weird to think about that they can just select, I'm going to spy on this person, basically. And it's kind of the grey area, she said, of the law, that as long as you're not recording someone, you're meant to always let someone know if you're recording them. And if you're not recording them for a text message or something, you can know about it. You can do sort of research on your subject for the case of this media report. And yeah, it's really creepy. And so you know the things, especially the things they don't want you to know, the things they're saying in private amongst each other and things before you do the interview. And that's creepy. So after that, we had morning tea, blueberry, cinnamon, almond, crunch, muffins. 11:30, we had panel discussion with very special guests, and I don't think any of these were vegan. John Minto, Unite, and he's sort of all minimum wage, $15. That's 12 American dollars or something, let's say. Yeah, and John Minto, he's known for the Halt All Racist Tours, the 1981 Springbok Tour, the South African rugby team, and they toured here, and they sort of segregation of Africans and English Africans, white and black. And they didn't like native Maori players. I mean, just regular New Zealanders, they weren't okay with that. They only wanted to play against white New Zealanders or whatever you want to say. And just general, there was protests and boycotts of South Africa at the time in the 80s, early 80s. And we went ahead and let them tour our country, and there were all kinds of protests and demonstrations and fights with the police. And my favourite is the people that rented the little light plane, and they were flying over dropping leaflets, which is dangerous. I wouldn't be dropping leaflets, but I think it's just amazing that they hired a plane and were buzzing the stadiums. And they started throwing flour bombs, which I definitely don't agree with, bags of flour out of a plane. And from memory, at least one of the players got hit on the head with one and sort of knocked unconscious from the weight and the momentum. And they were setting off flares and smoke bombs from it as well. And I definitely don't agree with things that harm or seriously distract people in this case. There were reports, I read a book about the Springbok tours just quickly, recently, and it mentioned that the police reports of this plane was like a suicide bomb, and these people were going to fly the plane into the crowd. And you would think they were really taking it seriously. We had barbed wire and barricades, shipping containers barricading the roads and things. And there are all kinds of like Molotov cocktails available. Like, it wasn't common, the Molotovs and that, but there were people with all kinds of crazy agendas. All the gangs got into it, and just it turned into anarchy, you could say. And so John Minto's known from that being a sort of leading protester of that being hit by the police. They call the batons that the police use here, their technical name is like a PR-24, I think, the ones that they used from reading the policeman's autobiography or account of the tour. And they're also known as Minto bars, John Minto. And Minto bars, I think it also ties into Minties, the British sweet, the white, the mint, Minties, and it was a Minty bar, and I don't know, and John Minto and a Minto bar, and yeah, that, just because he's known for being beaten over the head with them. Steve Abel from Greenpeace, and he's just sort of more about trees and things. He mentioned being vegetarian, and now he's an ex-vegetarian, and he said, I eat meat. And I always think, do people ever say, I eat flesh? And it's one of those things, I don't like saying the term meat, you know. Flesh, do you eat flesh? I didn't say, oh, I eat flesh. They just see it as returning back to a normal state, that they're a normal person again, I guess. And just the terms we use, maybe it does have an influence on how we think, and that it is socially acceptable to say meat and not flesh and things. And last was Margaret Taylor of Amnesty International, and she was just saying New Zealand's the first country in the world to totally outlaw the death penalty and capital punishment, until in 1961 we basically did it for everything but treason, and we got it in early 80s, I think, completely including treason. So we were the first country in the world to give women the right to vote. We beat those stupid wrong brothers, Richard Pearse, who I hope to see MOTAT, the Museum of Transport and Technology, I believe, or Travel Technology, not sure. I hope to see that before I leave. It's near where Elizabeth lives here. And see his plane. I think they have the actual plane that they got recovered, and they're definitely replicas of his stuff that he flew before the Wright brothers first give women the vote, to first to make awesome movies about Lord of the Rings, some of that animated crap. for us to do a lot of things. And apparently for us to completely outlaw the death penalty, which is cool, nuclear free. We're known for a lot of firsts in New Zealand, which is really cool. We had lunch, spinach and pesto phyllo pastry with onion jam, teriyaki vermicelli noodle salad, mixed bean salad, mesclun salad with artichoke, lemon and crushed cashew, leek and walnut tart. Then we had streaming workshop and presentations. Factory farming campaign strategy with Elliot Pryor talking about SAFE, what SAFE saw about things. And that's when I attended. I thought I'd go there and, to use the term, hear it from the horse's mouth and see what SAFE, that the campaign director, Elliot, of SAFE, what he really thought. And he said things like, things I'd never heard them say before, SAFE are against all farming. They are a vegan animal rights organisation. And I've never heard him say that when I see them on Close Up or Campbell Live or 3 News or TVNZ. It's always New Zealanders are against cruelty, we've got to ban this cage. Or this cage isn't yet big enough, we want them to be living in a shed, which is just another cage in Jordan White's opinion, but it's cage-free or whatever. And so I saw that. I disagreed with him very strongly about welfare reform and just the focus that, hey, you know, veganism, we stand for it, you know, in maybe 1,000 years' time or something, once 90% of the country buys the good free-range, whatever. Another one was direct action with Chris Hay of Greenpeace, the, quote, actions united. He does a lot of sort of chaining himself to things, blocking ships and ports, climbing up trees and chaining himself to things. I'm not really into that. Third, there's communication skills for animal rights activists, inspiring an audience to listen to you with Marion McDonald of SAFE. And she's the hypnotist woman, neuro-linguistic programming, you will go vegan. And I think there's some more subtle stuff to it rather than you're in my power and I command you to do this and that. Emmy saw her and Emmy said it was good, the things that she's just learning communication skills. William went with me begrudgingly to watch the whole factory farming campaign thing with Elliot. And we both were the only ones here that would disagree with it. I'm glad I chose it. It was good to hear just SAFE executives speaking their mind and to just have it direct. To say things like, kind of shocking things really, things like, we know factory farming's misused as a term, it's not really a real industry term, it's a slander, and I really don't like it for that reason. I find it, I don't want to call someone a name they don't want to be called. I liken it to the ginger issue. I think ginger is like the N-word, you know, I just think it's a terrible sounding word, and it just sounds really harsh. It's quite common in New Zealand to make fun of people with red hair, supposedly red hair. Gingers is the modern way of saying redheads, like redheads, you know, it's kind of acceptable to say, oh, you got red hair, are you redheads, they're all the same, whatever. Now it's gingers, and one in the North Island seems to be rang as like a orangutan, and I really hate that one, ranga, ranga. These little kids chanting and calling someone like an orangutan because the colour of the hair or the facial hair or bodily hair, you know, that's just, they mean it in a really terrible way. And isn't it weird? It's one of those things we don't like to think of ourselves as animals. And if we have maybe somewhat unusual hair colour, we compare the people as we make fun of them to animals known for being that colour, seeing ourselves as different than animals. And so calling someone a name they don't like, and I don't care who it is, factory farming, you know, I can live just fine talking about all kinds of farming, free-range farming, barn egg farming. It's all the same. It's about exploitation, hurting and killing others for our tradition, for our belief system, whatever it is. I'd rather not use a term. And to hear Elliot mention that he knows groups call all kinds of things, like the cow cubicles, about keeping them in sort of indoor shed things to some extent, open sheds, like they're a roof basically, and they stay inside, they're sort of penned in, lots of food. They have a sort of rolling plastic brushes like you might see in a car wash for themselves to rub up against, and yeah, they've got sort of sleep on mattresses, which are a bit weird sounding, and yeah, it's not really technically cow cubicles, according to SAFE, are not technically, by their definition, factory farming, but everyone's heard that slander so often, it's just used all the time, and they know it's kind of meaningless, they know that others are distorting its meaning, and maybe it's a bit like the vegetarian word, you know, vegetarian used to mean sort of vegan, what we call vegan now. And it just got stretched out, and oh, we got to be encompassing, it's got to mean things, and so some vegetarians don't eat animals with two legs or four legs, or animals that scream, oh, don't kill me, And they have all kinds of different definitions. So factory farming just means someone you disagree with. You're an evil, cruel factory farmer who doesn't care about other animals. And they talk about, you know, cruelty cases. And that came up in a thing at the end. I'll include it now. The last thing with Mark Eden, practical action planning, we sort of had to imagine, oh, let's say we're investigating, my group was picked to do an evil factory farm, and it was stinky and it was polluting. And what would we do? And other people were talking about, oh, you'd go to the council and try and get a permit, and, oh, let's see if this farmer, this person who has grows animals and fattens them in cages to have them killed, it was chickens too, which, you know, it strikes home for me. Let's see if they're known for animal cruelty in the past, and, oh, they've been banned for owning a farm for so long or working on one, and now they've just gotten back into it, and they're back to their old animal cruelty tricks. Well, it's all cruel, and it's all nasty, and it's all factory farming, whatever that term means, which literally, as Elliot said, it can mean anything, and it's just a bad word. It's just a word used to offend someone, to use against them, to throw at them, and I'm not for that. 2:30 was positive activism. Well, actually, I think, it was changed around a bit. Yolanda from the, Christchurch Vegetarian Society. I'm looking on my iPhone now. It says NZ Vegetarian Society. I know from the Christchurch Vegetarian Society. And she mentions that's vegan, and it's all vegan. And I've noticed these vegetarian groups seem to be run by vegans. And so we keep the term and, you know, all inclusive. And I'm going to start saying vegetarian vegan from now on. And I'm thinking, but most of the people are really glad to hear that. Oh, we got to be inclusive. And that seemed to be a message she brought up about staying positive. We can't be divisive. What's the thing you don't like about animal activism the most? And everyone seems to have written down previously division and, you know, infighting and stuff. And basically what that meant was people who say, hey guys, we're vegans, you know, we believe we shouldn't be hurting and killing other animals, you know, that they're our friends and we love them for who they are. How about we start telling other people that? And they say, nah, you got to say factory farming, mate, factory farming. We don't know what it means, but it's a bad word. We have to promote the good ones and the factory farmers and the cruelty and the big cages and the little cages and all that. And, I'm not for that. I really enjoyed meeting all the people from SAFE and the people that do agree with that, which I disagree with. I've shaken their hands. I've had photos taken with many of them. I've made them honorary members of the Invercargill Vegan Society, and they are my friends, but I have vegan friends and I have non-vegan friends, and I have friends of all stripes and colours, and some of them say peep, 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 and some of them say, you know, hey Jordan, how's it going? They're all my friends, but they know I disagree with them, and I think we can stay civil while disagreeing very strongly with people. And so basically people, the abolitionists were mentioned in one thing, the abolitionist slideshow I mentioned, in the slideshow, there was a picture of Elizabeth and William's table when they're in Altair Square here in Auckland, when they go there with a folding table and a couple of chairs, I think, and they have the pamphlets and just saying go vegan and promoting really nice things and everything. And that was mentioned as sort of the abolitionists, and I thought people would be cheering and clapping for that, you know, they'd be like, oh, wow, we have people that go out there and promote veganism. It didn't have a picture of them, and it didn't say where they were, and it just, I thought people would be excited to hear that. Wow, we can actually, it's okay to use the V word now. And of course, before that, I got mentioned with the Invercargill Vegan Society, which I'm really thrilled that I was mentioned. You know, everything we are doing now that there's four members, it's myself, Dan, Ricky, Natalie, what we're planning to do and just to get along and everything. And so that's just that feeling of, I do find it interesting that everyone in the crowd can say, oh yeah, we can't fight with each other, division. We sort of tell each other these things, we build kind of like the social construct, we frame the question and the arguments that's being divisive, yeah, that's divisive, oh, you can't say that, that's picking on other people, yeah, we can't disagree about that. Yet it's okay for us to disagree with people who are not vegan, for example, because we see that as harmful, and I personally see promoting the nice way to kill chickens or use the direct example, this practical action planning, this fictional situation where we have to basically go to the council and try and get them caught for dumping, you know, waste from all these chickens kept in horrible, evil factory farming cages. We have to try and get them through the law, that we have to do all kinds of tricks to get them and maybe the smell and get all the neighbours on our side and sort of break in and take pictures and stuff and to sort of put them out of business. And And my suggestion was that I wanted to be helpful. I wanted the group to say that, you know, that Jordan guy is all right. I said plainly a little bit after looking very interested and genuinely listening to them all with their ideas as they wrote them down on a piece of paper. I said, you know, we could just go there into this fictional town and we could go there each weekend and just talk with people who are interested in a public space about veganism and just ripen them up to the idea, as Donald Watson said before, that wonderful English sociologist we all love, living in Ireland, Dr. Roger Yates says, to ripen people up, to get them used to these things. And it was like, yeah, that's not going to happen, no, vegan world's never going to happen. But they did write it down in some extent. And but the rest of it was somehow that we got to get them through the legal system, oh, the pollution, oh, the water quality, oh, the drinking water, native rights, land rights, house values, you got to just sort of get them through the legal system some way. And I think that seems, you know, disingenuous. And the thing was never mentioned, the ethics. It was all about the waste, the pollution, you know, it's a stinky factory farm. It wasn't mentioned, oh yes, and there are thousands, tens of thousands, whatever, however many number of chickens are inside a shed and they're going to be killed. That wasn't the issue that we were promoting. We were to be promoting asking for cleaner water and less smell and things. Yeah, so just a fundamental disagreement. And it was mentioned, that was mentioned as a group's thing. It was mentioned at the start, it was read before everyone when all the groups combined again. And I started clapping, yay, we could promote veganism. And everyone else was like, in the audience, they didn't really take that idea seriously. You know, vegans promoting veganism, that's not the solution to animal exploitation. So I'm glad it was mentioned. I'm glad I did my little piece when everyone else wrote sort of paragraphs and I got sort of one sentence in. I think it's a powerful and very simple little seed of a sentence, just that we could, it would cost nothing to promote veganism and then explain why we disagreed not with the farmer and the people, what they do to animals. They grow up believing what they're doing is okay. But that we disagreed with all of it, with hurting anyone. It's cool that it was mentioned. I'm glad I got that mentioned. I'm glad that they read it. And I'm glad that everyone there heard someone suggesting from our group, supposedly, that we should promote veganism to help them, the ones that are being hurt and killed now. We had a tea break, orange, coconut, an almond slice, chocolate brownies, which were gluten-free. And yeah, as I stated, we ended on the practical action planning. And so some of the other ones were about animal testing and what to do for direct action things, protests against Spanish arrests and ways to hang yourselves off buildings to protest. And the Greenpeace guy was sort of chirping up with the things he'd do, like return to sender was one sort of solution he had. If they're dumping waste from some sort of pipes, to block up the pipe or to bottle up the water and throw it back to them and somehow sort of flood the building with it, and to put it in bottles from downstream rivers and take the water bottles, the clear water bottles, into like the city council office and say, here you go, you want to drink this? This is our lovely clean water that we have thanks to these farmers, and to do things like that. The other one was just different ways to, like he said, about going behind boats with a length of chain, jumping in the water, and you just drop the chain in the water. But the police have seen you enter the water with the chain behind the boats, and so they have to get the Navy divers to sort of inspect all the props and the propellers of the boats to check that they're not fouled, that they're not all tied up with the chain. And so that wastes the time, and they have to check, you know, to be completely sure that there's nothing, I'm thinking like North Shore, completely sure, that nothing's been tied around or any bombs or anything, and you're just wasting time and little tricks of locking yourselves on things. And yeah, I'm not into that. I just think a straight outright promoting of veganism, just being friendly with a $20 table bought at the warehouse and a folding chair and a friend, maybe a book to read if there's no one there, or better yet, to talk with your friend and always look open, to always be accessible to people who might be interested in the message, who can see the pamphlets you've got, and to not look like you're bored and just reading a book to kill time. I think that can really go far, that we can really ripen people up by promoting veganism. And my takeaway from this conference, it was the animal rights conference. It was almost all about welfare and single issues and things. I'm glad on the Friday night the Greens, the guy, you know, the same guy that said, oh, it's a personal choice, you know, if you want to eat other animals, if we want to have them killed, we've grown up killing certain ones, but as long as it's not the evil factory farm, which we all know is a very rigid and easily definable term used in the industry for themselves, of course. it was okay, it was a personal choice, as long as it wasn't evil, cruel factory farming. And to tell people otherwise, that was being, I don't know, I guess preachy, divisive, causing infighting. We wanted the movement to fail, whatever it would mean. But the Greens, their party material mentioned, oh, we are the only one to have the animal welfare thing, and maybe in 1,000 years' time, this Gary Francione fella, he's got this concept of animals, their own individuals, and yeah, that sounds about right, you know, year 3000. Build it up for you in the year 3000. It's year 2000, Daniel Johns, Silverchair, Australian band, for all my Australasian listeners out there, all five of you guys, including myself. it was good to see Francione mentioned and to see abolitionists mentioned, and that was meaning William and Elizabeth mainly. And I got mentioned for the Invercargill Vegan Society, and lots of people did come up to me, and I gave out lots of badges. I shook lots of hands, and I said I was really glad to meet them. Lots of people were glad to meet me. They'd heard of me. Some of them remember, oh, there's this guy from Invercargill. Oh, yeah, there's this guy, and he's, like, really vocal, real crazy and stuff. Like, he gets out there, and he's real, never shuts up. He gets out there, and, yeah, good, real good fella, eh? That sort of thing. And like, oh, yeah, I've heard of some guy in Invercargill too. Yeah, who is that guy? Before sort of letting them in on the joke. And, yeah, I've made lots of friends, and people had heard me on some radio stations that have been, similar radio stations like Animal Rights and Wrongs and Emmy, with Emmy and with Sam Tucker. And, oh, yeah, there's this guy in Invercargill. He doesn't really like sitting on, you know, leather couches. And I'm like, yeah, that guy probably doesn't like sitting on skin because he doesn't really like touching dead bodies and it makes him feel uncomfortable. Yeah, that guy, yeah, he's a real weirdo, that one. And so they all had a laugh and we all got along, and I gave out lots of badges and got compliments on the badges and the coins, the business cards I handed out. And yeah, the first day for the evening event, I went in my suit and I have a nice little Invasoc badge on it. The second, on the Saturday, I went in wearing my Invasoc sweatshirt or hoodie, as we say here, and jeans. And then on the last, I decided to go in my suit again, and because I wanted pictures to look my best, to look like an Aucklander, to fit in and not wear my sort of farming, rural, southern clothes. And, I got to meet heaps of people I'd read about. They got to meet me. I got to hand out things. They know that Invercargill has vegans promoting veganism there. They know that there are vegans in New Zealand that promote veganism. As I don't think I ever said as a moral baseline, but I was generally saying things like promote veganism because we believe that other animals matter for who they are, and that, you know, veganism was just the way of ending that kind of exploitation in particular. And I think people are receptive to it. I think by far the senses are stay together, anything else is divisive, they're attacking us, whatever. But at least they know that I'm getting out there, and that Elizabeth's getting out there, Emmy's getting out there, William's out there, that people all around the world are now feeling this way too. And I think Lauren was the one that mentioned Lauren Ornelius. I always forget how you say her surname. Sorry, Lauren. Like she's listening. Yeah, right. Her thing was something about in the US they have these abolitionists and they're very divisive and things like that. And just the general people in the room was, infighting. They're always picking on us, trying to get us, you know, some kind of con job. And yeah, it's, I think just by being friendly that people say, hey, it's not the case. Just like my non-vegan friends, they say, oh, this vegan guy, those vegan fellas, oh yeah, I know one of them. You know, it's Jordan, the guy I've known since I was 5. We went to kindergarten, we went to preschool, we went to primary school, we went to secondary, you know, high school together. Yeah, I know that guy, and he's vegan, and he's all right. And really, what more could we ask for than that? You know what intro to expect by now. Hello from Auckland, New Zealand, home of the Auck, I guess, Middle Earth, Auck, Auckland. And today was Monday, I'm told. I'm very confused with the days here, since it seems like every day is a holiday. Every day is a Saturday. Wasn't that the LMNOP song, New Zealand trivia there? And today I met with William and we took a bus. They have these things called buses in Auckland. And paying with a wireless contact NFC card or something, you just, instead of using coins, you hold up your wallet with this card inside. It's like a little credit card, plastic card with an antenna and a wireless chip inside, and you just hold it up to the scanner for a couple of seconds. The scanner beeps, shows a green circle, A-OK, and it takes the money off your account. And you do the same thing when you get off. Beep, beep, and it knows how much to charge you, and it charges you. So Auckland is very exciting. And I took this bus thing with all this crazy technology, and with William, we went to Greylin, and we met Elizabeth. And yes, I had seen Elizabeth. She met me at the airport when I came up here. But for the last few days, I hadn't been seeing her because she had to work and she couldn't attend the National Animal Rights Conference 2011. And Elizabeth was very nice as always. I got to see her house. I got to see all the crazy cats everywhere. And, you know, there's two of them. It's not like she's hoarding cats or anything, guys. I shouldn't give that impression or she'll get angry and hit me again. She's abusive. No, she's not. It was lovely to meet her and to see her pamphlets. She has posters of vegan activism from all around the world on her walls, Gary Francione, and things that Vincent's made about promoting veganism. And I gave her a few of the Invercargill Vegan Society A4 posters, and hopefully she's going to put those up. Yay! And together, looking at a tweet that Powell sent, Powell mentioned I was lucky to meet Elizabeth in person, and that I should give her a hug from Powell. And so we recorded a video, and William held my iPhone, and he recorded the two of us hugging. William got Elizabeth and I hugging, and it was from Powell. And so we're going to put that up on YouTube, and by the time you listen to this, it will be up on YouTube. But it was great. It's a dream come true. So there's a video of me hugging Elizabeth. She is a real person after all. And don't believe anyone that tells you otherwise. So for the rest of the day, I'm opening up my iPhone, good old multitasking here, looking through the photos. I've taken hundreds of photos since I'm here, about 400 pictures, I believe, in the last few days. I've got lots of pictures of Elizabeth's house. We recorded the video of us hugging for Powell. We walked to MOTAT, which is Western Springs, nearby. And MOTAT is New Zealand's Museum of Transport and Technology, I think. And we paid the $14 or so each, that's 10 American dollars, say, entry. And we got to see all New Zealand's history of transport and technology, you could say, and of. It appears they have a science exhibit all funded by Fonterra, a lovely dairy, so-called dairy conglomerate. And so there's Fonterra milk tank truck things everywhere, and they sponsor everything, and there's a stand about this truck, and it says, I'm looking at it now, how innovative they are. Our new tanker livery is the most visible sign of change, but just as important are the invisible innovations that have made our fleet safer, more efficient, and more environmentally friendly. How the computer systems use GPS to find out what farms to go to and what milk grades and fat levels, and how when they load up the tankers with milk, how the driver also takes a sample of it. And all the computer stuff on board, it all analyzes it for bad, bad stuff inside this milk, you know, the stolen infant formula for little, you know, for babies, you know, that we take by force after knocking up their mothers, forcibly impregnating them, killing the children, all that. You know, we don't want anything bad to be in this milk, you know, this white product, this white substance. And so as the tanker drives along, this thing automatically runs a test from the small sample. And if the test shows up bad, you know, they basically sort of open the hatches and spill the milk out all over the highway, causing car pile-ups behind the tanker and who knows what. But they can't, I'm reading here. The test strip is read electronically. If the tanker load tests positively, the milk is disposed of and further samples are sent for testing, reducing the risk and cost of contaminated milk entering the processing chain. Sounds lovely, doesn't it? At MOTAT, I got to see Richard Pearce, sort of the ward of it. And Richard Pearce is a man who not only looks a hell of a lot like me, he was also the first man in the world to ever fly in a powered aircraft. And he definitely bit those stupid wrong brothers up there in that America place. And by a few months, but he beat them. And his plane was simpler, of a better design. It's more like a microlight plane of today. His engine was both smaller, I believe, and it definitely made more horsepower. And did I mention the guy looks like me? And being a New Zealander, you know, we're kind of the first country in the world to give women the right to vote. We're definitely nuclear free, perhaps the first all out. to ban capital punishment. I'm very proud of my country. I love my country. And I hope that a lot of my friends overseas will move to Invercargill and we can make it the vegan capital of the world. So there's at least four members that actually live in Invercargill that are in InvSoc, the Invercargill Vegan Society. And I'd love to make that a few thousand. So come on, guys, there's only one way to make that happen, to have all my friends fly in and move to wonderful Invercargill in Southland, New Zealand, the bottom of the world. So seeing Richard Pearce, you could see his planes. There's two of them. There's a replica of the first one he ever made, and that was, it's really incredible. It's a replica. It has parts from the actual thing, the engine and the prop from it, and those were basically thrown out when he died. And many years or decades later after he died, they sort of went through the Christchurch dump. They knew where all the stuff from his day was being put, and they recovered it. They managed to find quite a few of his parts, including the engine, which he made himself, and everything was made by himself. This man living alone in the middle of nowhere on a South Island farm. And he built all these machines. He made a motorcycle. He put a sort of engine on a bike, and it had self-inflating tires, and it could do all kinds of things. It had pumps sort of built in if it sprung a leak, and it could, yeah, it was just incredible. He made all sorts of little machines, but his best things were his planes. And everyone thought he was mad, and it was mad Richard Pearce and all the locals, you know, their lives were the farmers, and they probably cars were somewhat radical. Petrol engines were sort of used on, you know, on the farms, but the idea of making a plane, of flying like a bird, that was ridiculous. So he worked on it by himself in his shed, and he did sort of test flights on his in his fields, and he had a thing for crashing into the hedging surrounding his farm. He always seemed to crash into the hedging, and it's like, well, Richard, couldn't you find like somewhere better? But, you know, I can't criticize the guy who's the first man in the world to build a plane. Sure as hell wasn't Jordan Wyatt. And possibly overseas, there were people that flew before Richard Pearce as well. It's disputed. But I definitely know he beat the Wright brothers, so that's something. I'm very proud of him and the fact that I look like him. And so there was the first plane, a replica of it, and the original parts in a glass case. And the utility plane, and this one is, I mean, it's incredible. He built it between about 1928 to the 1940s. And it was basically, it sort of looked like a microlight plane, but the main thing about it was the utility plane. It had the engine and it had the propeller housing, and it would take off vertically like a helicopter with the spinning blades, you know, up top, and it would fly straight up, and you could sort of park it anywhere like a car. How we see like parking a car now. So you'd fly up vertically, then you'd tilt it. You'd tilt the whole engine assembly, including the propeller, like. How much would that weigh? They said sort of now the historians and the people who wrote his sort of the resources about him have all mentioned how would that work? I mean, how heavy would the spinning revolving mass of all the engine be to rotate it into the conventional sort of plane horizontal outlook? It would be very difficult, you'd think, but he was working on this, and hey, this guy definitely flew before the Wright brothers, so he obviously knew what he was doing, and he was working it out as he went along. And not taking no for an answer, he was working out his problems. So yeah, this plane that would take up vertically, VSTOL we'd call it now, vertical short takeoff and landing, and even the Americans can't get that B-22 Osprey thing going right. It's a plane that, well, it has two engines that take off, it takes off vertically like a helicopter with the blade spinning sort of vertically, you could say. And then the whole sort of engines, they rotate down to a normal sort of orientation, and they get better fuel economy by doing that. And it's had all kinds of crashes and complex, and it's not pressurized in the back. And so, yeah, my countryman Richard Pearce, you know, he was working on this stuff a hell of a long time ago. So it was great seeing his planes, and I touched them. I touched the utility plane. I touched one of the wings of it, and it's sort of probably a no-no, but, you know, I look like the guy, so that sort of gives me special rights, how I see it. So to see his motorcycle was cool. We saw quite a few old New Zealand, this is what New Zealand back in the day was like, and a time before iPhones and iPads and iOS and iMacs. It sounds like a bloody awful time. There's some stuff like, you know, women couldn't vote, there was a war going on or something, blah, blah, blah. You know, there was no iPhones. It sounds bloody awful. Going through it. We went we got to see this thing called the Sky Tower in Auckland. And it's this huge building and the tallest tower in the Southern Hemisphere, and it's just incredible. And we had to pay something like $30 each to go up, and it was well worth it. And I was very afraid. We're 200 odd meters above the ground, and there's glass sort of floor panels, and there's a glass window in the lift in the floor, and as well as you can see through the glass lift, you can see the glass windows on the building, the large windows. So I was packed into this tiny little elevator with all these people, and there were bits where it was absolutely freaky as hell for me, like jump out of your skin scary, when the windows flashed by. And you realized, wow, I am centimeters, you know, a couple inches from the outside of this building, and I'm going up and up and up and up. It feels fast, but it's just that feeling of you're standing on the edge of nothing, that, you know, you're seeing all these other skyscrapers around you, and just the glass, it made me feel really uneasy since I don't like heights. And I took some pictures of myself walking on the glass windows up there.
I'm allowed to hold on, right?
So the sign says, this glass floor is 38 millimeters thick. It is as strong as the concrete floors you are standing on. But I noticed the metal frame around it, the metal frame is actually buckled, like it's actually bending. The metal, not the glass. So here goes. I came up here on the 20th of July, remember? 2011. 1969 was when man walked on the moon. So what was the saying then? That couldn't be heard by the Boeing 737 noise? One small step for man, one giant leap for in the cargo kind. I feel creepy. The metal bends when you walk on the metal. Other things, I got pictures of Elizabeth and William up the top of it, and we went to the vegan restaurant, as it says on the sign, the Golden Age again. And it was great to be there with Elizabeth and to take photos of her, to take photos of William and us and the meals that we had, and I'll share those forever and care about them and love watching them myself and seeing them. And I hope other people enjoy seeing what vegan food looks like in Auckland, New Zealand. I also made a travel bug. I released a travel bug geocoin thing I made for geocaching. One of my InfoSoc coins I had engraved with a unique number, and it's put into a geocache pretty much opposite the Sky Tower. And so this coin, people see it there, geocaches. They'll use GPS devices to find this plastic container hidden in a bush. And this coin, the point is that people pick it up. It has a goal to visit vegan restaurants in New Zealand. So by finding this, non-vegans, they'll at least see the word vegan. They'll see the InfoSoc website on the back. And it encourages them to go to vegan restaurants and to take this to vegan restaurants and to see how many you can go to. And to have all the kilometres it travels across the country all calculated up. While I was here, I got another travel bug, which was a rubber chicken, like a rubber chicken toy, a small one, and that came from America, and their goal was for this to visit Australia and New Zealand, Little Yeller Chicken, it was called in American English, yay. And this little rubber chicken had been over 10,000 kilometres around the world, from Arizona, California, Guam. And it was in Auckland, New Zealand when I found it, at the corner of Victoria and Queen Streets, which is one of Auckland's busiest intersections. So that's great. So I went to the Sky Tower. I spent a lot of time today with Elizabeth and William, and we had vegan food. We promoted veganism with this coin by taking some pictures of ourselves with it and then leaving it in this container for non-vegans to find and to hopefully move around all of New Zealand. And when I'm home in Invercargill, I'm going to pick up a couple more of these engraved coins with a different number on them. And the goal of these will be to travel the world promoting veganism and for people to visit vegan restaurants in their country and to take a photo of this coin at vegan restaurants. And so hopefully it's going to be a fun way to promote veganism. On my last night in Auckland, New Zealand, it's Jordan Wyatt coming to you from, well, I just said it, Auckland, New Zealand. Today, which was Tuesday, I believe, again, confused with these days since I'm not working and every day is a Saturday, it's a little odd. Today, Tuesday, the last night I have here, well, the day before this last night I have here, to repeat myself, I went geocaching with William Paul. We found one that had stuck, that had really been difficult to find, and by Britomart, we were off by centimetres to find this little disguised magnetic container with a log book inside of it, this sort of modern treasure hunting using GPS devices like my iPhone and his Android device. So we found that. That was good, the third attempt. Then we agreed to meet with two other animal rights activists, and Deirdre Sims of New Zealand Open Rescue, and also Carl Scott, the man in a cage, the Dunedin man who decided to be in a cage to promote the banning of factory farming, battery cages, whatever they like to be called. And Carl was a former slaughterhouse worker and an army soldier, and then he decided to be vegan over time. And so it was nice to meet them both, and we talked about the things we might disagree about, how William and I both agreed in promoting veganism as sort of the moral baseline, the starting point, and that it was easy and that we were ready and quite capable of talking about veganism in 2011 New Zealand. And Deirdre and Carl both thought that we could work together and we might disagree on some things that maybe the rest of the non-vegans in New Zealand weren't quite there yet, I believe is how they'd put it, and that welfare things would help on the way, which Willie and I disagreed with, but we all enjoyed meeting each other. We talked and we had food together at Roasted Addiction, an addiction spelt with a Q, which is some kind of bloody Auckland thing. The menus were good. It's a lot of non-vegan stuff, and sort of making William and my point about sort of free range, we didn't say so much, it just makes people feel better, but we said we thought anything other than veganism was sort of not really the truth and not really helping. But looking here, all throughout the menu it says if-range bacon and free range and free range eggs, and there's some kind of conscientious cafes or something. It's some kind of organization, sort of like a fair trade label. And I've seen that in Auckland a few places. And, oh, we only use free range eggs and we compost our waste scraps and we do this and we do that. And it's just sort of a way to make people feel good about themselves. Well, I don't really think it's really doing much, you know, it's not that much work for the restaurants, and they get to say that they're really the good guys. They get sort of a badge of honor for it. And so it's kind of weird. It made me feel gross holding a menu that mentions all these obviously non-vegan things. I find it creepy, and the idea that it says free range to make us feel better about what we're doing to other animals. I ordered the Tofu Delight, which cost $16.50 New Zealand, so that'll be, I don't know, $12 American, I'd guess. And it's vegan and gluten-free friendly, so I guess you can order it, I don't know, without gluten. Fried or boiled tofu laid over a bed of salsa beans. They actually said or salsa beans. Spelling mistake. Great one. Avocado, tomato, mesclun, and served with capsicum coulis sauce. Okay. And some of the others had a quesadilla, which is a vegan quesadilla, and it mentions that. And so that was really cool. And so when we left, we took a picture together. I'm looking now. There's one of Deirdre, William, and Carl. And it's really nice to see them all three smiling vegans. And then William took one with me, with Deirdre, Jordan in the middle, and then Carl. So that was really cool. And I'm glad I got to meet Deirdre. I'd heard of her a lot. I'd seen her on the news. I'd talked about things that Open Rescue does when they promote, well, they investigate sort of factory farms, as they say, and they go to Safe with the footage, and it's used in sort of safe campaigns for welfare reforms. And it was nice to meet her. We got along very well. We both talked, and I told her about the Boston Vegan Association that Carl and Deirdre hadn't heard of, about the BVA, and that they were a real inspiration for William and I. And that I told them how I showed them photos on my iPad, how the Boston Vegan Association go out and have street stalls about veganism, and they give away free food with a conversation. They have books, I believe. I'm not sure, they probably sell them, you know, at a very minimum profit. Books like Gary Francione's books, for example. They have lots of pamphlets they give away, as well as the food. They have videos and kiosks and now iPads, and just really friendly people, and people are willing to talk with them about veganism. And I said, that's what William and Elizabeth do here in Auckland. I showed some pictures of their smaller table, a little folding table with some pamphlets sort of strapped on the top of it and ready to give to people. And people are greeted with a smile from Elizabeth and Emmy. Hopefully soon, now that Emmy lives here. and William, and that, you know, it's 2011 and we really can do this. Yes, we can, is that wonderful President Obama kid, you know. Yes, we can ban Gitmo. Yes, we can get out of wars. Yes, we can stop giving bailouts to billionaires. Well, yes, we can really promote veganism in 2011. Another thing that was interesting to me was stopping by a sort of hemp store, and this was, you know, it's not my cup of tea, you could say. So everything was, all the clothing and sort of hair care products and everything was made out of hemp, and they sell hemp for animal consumption, labeled on the thing, and sort of, yeah, lots of horrible highs and sort of weird sort of drugs, sort of things like that. Not my scene. I took some pictures that they had sort of jackets and those sort of Antarctic exploration caps with a sort of cloth on the outside or skin, I forget what they were on the outside. They've got this sort of fur inside. I don't know if it's, you know, real fur or if it's synthetic fur or whatever. And they have a sea shepherd badge on them, a metal sea shepherd badge on the front. And, you know, it's like the skull with the sort of crossbones with the trident and the sort of shepherd's crook, which I've always thought that was weird. You know, I mean, I know they're conservation, they are not animal rights. Sea shepherd is not animal rights. The idea of a sea shepherd, of someone looking after the rest of, I don't know, animal life and the shepherd and the crooks, and, you know, it's sort of pro-farming, isn't it? So they have a few of those jackets, presumably made out of hemp as well, with the same logo designs, as well as the woolly sort of furry whatever hats. And that was weird seeing it as sort of a mainstream brand. It's like, I guess, the anarchy symbol now. That's what Sea Shepherd sort of stands for. We're cool, we're hip, we're edgy, we're out there, you know, taking on the world. We can be this pirates and all that. I guess that's how their brand's seen now by non-vegans, because this was not a vegan place. They also had the, I don't know how you say his name, sorry, Dr. Bronner's, the organic soaps and the, it's all hemp and it's the, yeah, lotions and potions, and $50 for the huge bottles and about $20 for the really tiny bottles. But out of my price range, and I didn't want to take it back on through in my suitcase. I didn't want to take it on the plane and have the bottle getting thrown about. And yeah, walking around Auckland, I got to see the Sunflower Vegetarian Restaurant, and they mention on their menu something about being all strictly vegetarian or something, and yet they have things that say like bacon and chicken and beef and things, and presumably it's some kind of tofu, fake artificial meat thing. And I find it creepy just seeing it on the wall anyway. So it's cool to see vegetarian restaurants, as they say vegetarian, and maybe, William asked, maybe most of it is probably vegan, they said. It's exciting for me to go and visit these places and to talk with them about veganism, and so that they see that there's more vegans out there, even if it is just the two of us. You know, that's two more people that came into the stop, into the shop, and we took a menu, and I'm like, oh, maybe we can come back here tomorrow, knowing that I'd be leaving, and just trying to appear helpful and useful so I wasn't a waste of their time, which I kind of was. And on the way out, I saw an Aston Martin, got all excited, and I took a picture of it once the driver sort of pushed the little clicker, the remote, beep, beep, and locked up his car, and, you know, I think it's a V12 Vantage or something, I'm not sure exactly, I'm looking at it now. Beautiful Aston Martin worth, you know, $200,000, $400,000, I don't know what they cost in New Zealand. But my friend Woody loves Aston Martins, and they're just a gorgeous, gorgeous car. We walked past the Revive restaurant, which is strict vegetarian, they consider themselves, I think they say. Although they do mention things like, we only use the soft cheese, the good dairy, something like that. And then afterwards, last but not least, at 3 o'clock, I managed to meet my cousin David Wyatt, and he's a really nice guy. And I haven't seen David much in my life, but it was nice to meet him at a cafe, restaurant, bar thing. And we went to a couple of them, and he's just a really good guy. He uses an Android device, and that makes him the devil, in my opinion. But just like William, you know, we superior Apple users, we have to sort of tolerate the presence of these heathens, these unwashed heathens and cretins. So what more can I say? It was great to meet him, Android device or not. He's a great guy. I like my cousin a lot. I wish we could stay in touch more, but he lives in this godforsaken part of New Zealand, Auckland, home of the Orcs. And it was just a great day. It was wonderful to see vegetarian restaurants and to meet other vegans, to talk about veganism. I spoke about veganism with my non-vegan cousin, and I gave him a couple of IMSOC badges. He mentioned he had a vegan friend, Chris, and who apparently runs a sort of well-known New Zealand site, which is exciting. I'm like, oh, I have to go and visit that site and say hi to him. And this guy apparently had this sort of hang-up about peanut butter, that he had peanut butter all the damn time for protein, as he saw it. And I thought, well, so people really do get worried about protein in New Zealand. Maybe it's a North Island thing. You know, oh, where do you get your protein? Where do you get your protein? I thought it was some kind of American ad campaign. You know, like here we have milk has calcium. You need calcium for strong bones, calcium-trim milk. It's good for your bones, for growing children. They need a glass of milk every day. I thought it was some kind of ad like, eat animal flesh, you know, kill cows and chickens and sheep. That's where you get your protein from. And without that, your muscles will explode and wilt away and sort of like deflate like little balloons and who knows what. But yeah, so we kind of both joked about this guy that's got some kind of peanut butter fix. And I made jokes about sort of heating it up with a spoon, you know, like and injecting it and sort of with a syringe and all kinds of things, smoking it, all kinds of like a weird addiction. It sounds like a weird thing to me to say, where do you get your protein from? Oh, I get it from peanut butter. So I said to my cousin David that I hope he tells him that there's much better places for protein than peanut butter, and I hope he'd look into it and that maybe he'll get in contact with me and we can talk about being vegan, that we're both vegan and both hopefully good influences on non-vegans, including my cousin. So all in all, it was a great day. And I'm somewhat reluctantly looking forward to going back to Invercargill tomorrow, all things considered. I'm taking a shuttle at 1 p.m. to the airport, and my plane leaves about 2:40. So it takes apparently about an hour to get there, so that I'll be arriving at 2. That's 40 minutes before my flight. And that'll go quickly, I'm sure. And it's kind of scary. It's, you know, making a plane, and what if I miss it, and what if the weather conditions in the South Island have been having some weird snow, like a freak cold snap, and the airports have been closed, some of them. Apparently everything's all A-OK now. But going back to Invercargill soon. And so I look forward to catching up on my emails and sorting my photos and everything, and being back, most of all, with my chicken friends.
Spoiler alert, I caught the correct planes and made it back to Invercargill. I had a great time meeting my friends Elizabeth, Emmy and William, as well as so many others, Chris Noaro, Deborah Ashton, Carl Scott, Amanda Broughton, Susan Elias. Yes, it's fair to say there were more than a handful of vegans in Auckland. I wasn't the only vegan in that village. The New Zealand National Animal Rights Conference did have a strong welfare message. There's only one way to change that. For New Zealand vegans to get out there and promote veganism, like Elizabeth Collins, William Paul, and now Emmy James of Auckland, out there on the street with vegan pamphlets, and hopefully little Jordan Wyatt with his precious show and Chicken Friends, to tell the message of how we love our chicken friends, that we want them to be respected, that they, as other animals, matter, and not because of that cute peeping noise they make on the day of hatching, as demonstrated by this old recording from my original iPhone. Thank you very much for listening to my show. You can find the script for this episode, as well as downloads for every episode of Coexisting with Non-Human Animals, at coexistingwithnonhumananimals.co.nz. If you want to contact me, I'd really love to hear from you. Please send me an email to jaywontdart@gmail.com, jaywontdart@gmail.com. Two people who've gotten in touch with me through email are Jeff Chapman of Australia and Wendy Hamblin of Canada. Thank you both very much. It's lovely to think there are other vegans out there, all over the world. We're spreading like a plague. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter, Jordan Wyatt, W-Y-A-T-T. Thank you for listening.
Away from the ocean of animals as things, and toward the moral personhood of animals. The choice is ours. If you're not vegan, go vegan. It's easy. It's better for you. It's certainly better for the planet. And most importantly, it's the morally right thing to do.